Last week we looked at part one of a discussion in chapters 8 through 10 of a better covenant. We started that last week in chapter 8 with the prophecy from Jeremiah 31. And tonight we're going to continue in Hebrews chapter 9, his discussion of a better covenant. Now, there's a difficulty in Hebrews, and I don't know if this is I've tried really hard not to be this way. My temptation as just a student of the Word is I like the theory. I like the philosophy. I like the intricacies and the nuance. For me, it's tempting and it's dangerous to leave the practicality out. I just want to talk about the theology, basically. And the difficulty of Hebrews is so much of the first part of the book, there's a transition in chapter 11, but so much of the first part of the book is a technical discussion of salvation and atonement. That's what it is. It's a technical discussion about the mechanics, the various parts, the inner workings of justice and sacrifice, and various religious components. That's what the book of Hebrews is for the first part. And then he switches, of course, in chapter 11 into being, I think, a little more practical. And chapter 9 is probably the worst chapter in this respect. For me, especially, if I'm not careful, this chapter can be very esoteric, of little practical value. We just go deep into the theology of atonement and talk about that. And it's interesting, don't get me wrong, but the question, of course, is always, what does it mean for us, the practicality of it? What does it matter? And as we go through chapter 9 specifically, and I've tried to do this as we've gone through the book, because for me the temptation in Hebrews is just to ramble on about theology for hours and hours on end. Literally, I could talk about it for hours. Now, I haven't done that, thankfully. Mostly thankful for you guys. The primary question the author is answering is, how does the sacrifice of Christ save us? How does that do that? And especially contrasted with the things in the old law, the things in the Old Testament that we've been told multiple times by this point in the book, did not save those people, did not bring perfection, did not bring guiltless conscience, did not purify their souls. So the thing that they had versus the thing that we have, why is the thing that we have so much better, right? Now, the author begins by re-examining the tent, the quote, this is a quote, right? The tent made by human hands. We're not going to read the first part of Hebrews chapter 9. This is what he's talking about, the tabernacle, the various things. I know some of that text is small, but this is the best picture. I think the clarity of the picture outweighs the smallness of the text. This was the tabernacle. From Exodus 25 through 31 and 35 through 40, this is the outskirts, and then you had the bronze altar. The priest would come this way. There's the basin of washings, which he talks about in several places. The inner place, we've got the showbread, and we've got the lampstand. And then this here is the curtain, the veil, the separation between the holy place, this whole thing. This whole thing is holy. This is the holy place. And this is the most holy place. This is where that's the Ark of the Covenant right there. And the author in chapter 9 begins with a discussion of these things, and he ends that discussion with, about these things we cannot now speak in detail, because they were gone. Even by this point, they were gone. They didn't have a lot of this stuff, specifically the Ark of the Covenant. And it's interesting at the death of Jesus, of course, what happens to the veil? The veil of the temple was torn in two. There's a significant thing, we'll get to that as we go through this. So the priest would enter, he would enter and do his various priestly things in here, and then once a year, the high priest would enter into this place and make offering for sacrifice. Hebrews 9, 9 and 10, according to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices are offered. They cannot, and again, I've said this already, cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper, but deal only with food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of Reformation. The question the author is driving at, what then do we have that does perfect the conscience of the worshiper? How is what we have been given through Christ better than this stuff? How is what we have better than this? And we could apply this. He talks about the tabernacle, but this applies to the temple throughout history in Jerusalem. The temple had many of the same ideas and elements, and it was constructed a little bit differently. It was permanent, for one thing, right? But they were doing all the same sorts of things in the temple. And the author's question throughout this whole book up until now is, how is the thing that we have through Christ better than that? What does it do that that could not do? How does it work when the old things did not work? That's what we're talking about. And we're going to see three things. Salvation comes through mediation. Three things in chapter 9 that the Hebrew writer gives us that are better about our salvation, the things that make us perfect when those things did not. Number one, salvation comes through mediation. Now, the idea of mediation, often in covenant agreements, right? We're talking about covenants, right? Agreements between multiple parties. There was a mediator. And the mediator was a go-between, right? Somebody who understood both sides. We understand mediator. We have mediators today who settle disputes between two sides. Someone who understands both sides, who served as a go-between to ensure the satisfaction of both parties. That's a mediator. Now, in the Old Testament, the high priest served as the mediator. One who could understand both sides and work to accomplish an agreement between both sides so that there would be satisfaction of the covenant that had been made. Now, as we've previously seen in this book, the high priest was imperfect at this. He was not a great mediator, primarily because he could only understand one side, right? The high priest was only human. He was not a real good mediator in the sense that he really, truly only understood one side. He was constantly replaced. He died, and then the new one would come up, and then he died, and the new one came up. So this mediation didn't even last for very long, maybe 40 years at a time. You had one high priest serving as mediator, and the sacrifices, even though he was mediating, the sacrifices still needed to be offered year after year after year after year after year. So while this was an important part of the covenant, it was very flawed, very imperfect. The salvation, the agreement, the covenant relationship that could be accomplished through the mediation, through a party, through one person who understands both parties, that wasn't happening in the Old Testament. Well, of course, we come to Hebrews 9:15. Therefore, he, Jesus, is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. He is the mediator. He understands both sides. He understands the covenant. He, in fact, instituted the covenant, right? He understands all the different elements of the agreement, and he understands both sides perfectly. So he can serve as the go-between between us and God. How did he come to be this mediator? Hebrews 9:11 and 12, but when Christ appeared as high priest of the good things that have come, kind of a subtle dig as opposed to the bad things that were, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not the tabernacle, that is not made of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by the means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. That holy place, that picture that we had up there a moment ago, right? The priest would go in through the curtain to the holy place, and then he'd go even in further to the Holy of Holies. That he's saying that is a thing that happened, but what Christ has done is analogous to that, but better. It's like that, but better than that, right? He has entered into the holy places, not the physical ones, but what made the Holy of Holies so holy? It was God's presence, right? The Ark of the Covenant that housed physically God's presence tangibly on the earth. So when it says he entered into the holy places, Jesus, he has gone to where God is, entered into God's presence. We keep reading Hebrews 9:24. For Christ has entered not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven, as if it wasn't clear enough, into heaven itself now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. There's that idea of mediation, right? That he is the one who is administering on our behalf, that he's doing things for us. Jesus has gone to where the Father is, entered the holy place, and thus can intercede for us perfectly, where the high priest could not do that. The high priest was great, but he could not mediate the covenant between God and man like Jesus, because he could not intercede for us with God like Jesus. Number two, salvation comes through the shedding of blood. Hebrews 9:22 through 23, indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. Thus, it was necessary for the copy of the heavenly things, that would be the Old Testament things, right? The showbread and the lampstand and all these different things, to be purified with these rites, but the heavenly things themselves, the things that are in heaven, with better sacrifices than these, the sacrifices of animals. Hebrews 9:18 through 20, therefore not even the first covenant was inaugurated, was put into effect, let's say, without blood. For when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of the calves and the goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book of itself and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you. Now, you'll immediately, I think a lot of us will immediately recognize a familiar phrase. The blood of the covenant. Be thinking about that as we go through this. Where does that phrase come from that is in your mind so clearly? Because you've probably heard that. My guess is that's on your top 10 list of scriptures you've most heard, because you hear it fairly often in one specific way. Hebrews 9, 12 through 14, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by the means of blood of goats and calves, but by the means of his own blood. So what the high priest would have to do, he'd have to slaughter an animal, and then he'd have to sprinkle himself with the blood, and that was what allowed him to enter through those curtains without just being, boom, struck dead. That was part of the thing that God had said, right? You can't do that unless you do this sacrificing thing. Thus securing an eternal redemption, for if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience, the difference between the flesh and the conscience, right, from dead works to serve the living God. Salvation does not come, forgiveness cannot come without the shedding of blood. Now, from the perspective of justice, that would be your blood, right? The blood of the person who sinned. From a perspective of justice, getting what we deserve, the one who sinned, the one who deviated from the covenant, would be the one who would have to offer the blood. But the forgiveness, the redemption, the idea of atonement, is that someone else's blood is taking that place. The need for blood is, of course, wrapped up in the justice of righteousness of God. Sacrifices have to mean something. Forgiveness has to come through sacrifice, because God just can't hand wave away the sins. That would violate his sense of righteousness and justice. Inseparably linked, this is my little cow, who they had to kill a lot of cows. I feel bad for those cows. Inseparably linked to the idea of blood, salvation comes through death. Now, in the Old Testament, it was so many animals that died. So many animals that died every year. Over and over and over, and they had to keep killing them. And if you didn't have a certain kind of animal, then you could provide this kind of animal. And if you didn't have that kind of animal, then you had this thing that you should do. And there was all these different levels of commandment, right, for the different animals that you would have to bring at different times for different sins. So if you committed one kind of sin, you'd offer this kind of animal. And if you committed a different kind of sin, you'd offer this kind. And it just never ended, right? We come to Hebrews 9, 15 through 17. Therefore, he is the mediator of a better new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. Those animals dying did not redeem them. Had to be this other death. For where there is a will involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. Like if my parents make a will, I don't get all their stuff until they're dead. Right now, I'm just saying that the things that we think about wills in this culture, you write down, when I die, I want all this to happen with my stuff, and I want X, Y, or Z, whatever it is that you write in a will. But that doesn't go into effect until the person who made it dies, right? Otherwise, they could just give me the stuff. My parents could just say, here, Chris, have this, and then I'd have it, or any number of things. But where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. For a will, it takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. Now, there's a bit of confusion. Every translation has problems. This is one of the problems I have with this particular translation. The word covenant and will are the same word here, diatheke. Same, it's the same original word. This, my laser pointer working? This word and this word are the same word. I don't know why they've translated it different. Now, I get they're trying to get the impression of in modern context, right? When he's talking about the death of a person and the will, and I understand that. But this is the same word, the idea of an agreement between two parties. And what God's saying here is that agreement only goes into effect at a death. Now, in the Old Testament, it went into effect at what death? The death of the animals. Death of the firstborn, really, in Egypt, you could even say it, that's when it went into effect, when the angel passed through Egypt and killed all the firstborn. Of course, the covenant that we are under now, when did that go into effect? The death of Jesus. And note, it's interesting that the death of Jesus applies backward in time as it does forward. It truly is the focal point of history. What does he say? A death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. All the things that they did, now they sacrificed the animals and they offered all the sacrifices and the blood and the washings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But their sins were not truly forgiven until Jesus died. That sacrifice, those things that they did, kept them in the covenant continually, kept them in the agreement. But their transgressions of that covenant and that agreement did not really get redeemed until the death. Now, of course, from God's perspective, right, if he exists outside of time, he's looking at the whole thing at once. So from God's perspective, it all happens sort of, it's kind of wishy-washy there, right? It's hard to kind of wrap your head around how God perceives that. But the death of Christ really is the focal point of history. It applies to all the people back then, and applies to all the people up now until the end of time. It is the thing, the major event throughout history. Hebrews 9, 26 through 28, as it is, Jesus has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear the second time, not to deal with sin, right? His appearance the second time is not going to be to deal with sin because he already did that. Sin's already dealt with. He's already done what he needs to do to deal with sin. But what is he going to do when he appears? To save those who are eagerly waiting for him. And in this sense, it's not to save them from sin because he already did that. What is he saving people from when he appears the second time? The burdens of life. Saving us from the limitations of the flesh. Saving us from our separation and our inability to perceive God fully. Because he's already saved us from sin. That's the thing that happened already. That's the thing that happened when you submitted to him in baptism. Hooray, your sins are already forgiven. But there's going to be more salvation that comes when he returns again. Now, these three things all link together, of course. His blood was shed by the means of his death. And that death, of course, allowed him to enter the holy place and mediate for us. The three components, mediation, blood, and death, those three things, you can't really separate them. Because he is a mediator, because he died, and that death is what shed his blood. And you can't also separate that, incidentally. To do any of that, first he had to leave the holy place, because he was already there, right? He was already in God's presence from the beginning of time. So he had to leave the holy place, become human, in order to have life and blood at all to give. Which is why, incidentally, the birth of Christ is, in my opinion, the second most important event in history. Maybe one in 1A. Because you can't have any of the previous things without his birth and descension to flesh. Practically speaking, again, the question is practically, so what? It's all interesting and I could talk for hours about it, but how do we interact with that practically? What does it mean for us? And why does it matter? Right? It's interesting to think about the contrast between animal sacrifices and the sacrifice of Jesus and the holy places. And it's interesting to think about when Jesus died, of course, the veil of the temple was torn in two. And what does that signify, of course? That now anybody can enter into the presence of God, right? And isn't that what we do through Christ in prayer? That we enter into his presence in a sense? That we approach the throne of God with boldness and confidence, right? So there's all these sort of interacting pieces. But what does that mean practically speaking? 1 Corinthians 10, 16 through 22. The cup of blessing, that would be this cup right here, right? The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not participation in the blood of Christ? Remember, without the shedding of blood, there can be no forgiveness of sins. The bread that we break, is it not participation in the body of Christ, the body that died for you? Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Consider the people of Israel are not those who eat the sacrifices participants in the altar. What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything or that an idol is anything? No. I imply that what pagan sacrifice they offer to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake in the table of the Lord and the table of demons. What is he getting at here? This particular phrase. You can't drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Jesus only mediates for you if this is the only covenant you've agreed to. You can't be trying to have relationships with all sorts of gods. And that might be the God of yourself, or the God of material possessions, or the God of your family. You have one God, one covenant. And as long as you are only in one covenant, Jesus continues to mediate for you. But if you start branching out and deviating and going into having all sorts of different covenants, that mediation no longer holds up. He does not continually intercede. Mark 14, 22 through 24, as they were eating, he took bread and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to him and said, "Take, this is my body." Similar language, right? And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to him, and they drank all of it. They all drank of it, And he said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many." You probably heard that verse, or variants, because there's some in Matthew and I think Luke. How many times do you think you've heard that in your life? I mean, dozens at least, hundreds maybe, I don't know. Depends how old you are, I guess. The priests continually offered blood sacrifice for the people, and that is what kept them in the covenant. These sacrifices over and over and over and over and over. They remained in the covenant even though their sins weren't forgiven, right? From a technical perspective. This is a technical idea. Their sins weren't really gone until Christ, but they remained in the covenant available for Christ to forgive retroactively through those sacrifices, through the continual blood of those sacrifices. We participate in the blood of the covenant in a very specific way. The thing that keeps us in the covenant, the thing that keeps Christ's sacrifice applying to the sins that we... Because you don't stop sinning, right? Who sinned last week? I hope you all raise your hand there. Well, maybe not the small kids, I guess. I don't know. Maybe you went a week. Good for you. You're amazing. What keeps you in the covenant and under the forgiveness of that death is your participation in the blood of the covenant. That continual participation as they would over and over and over again. We do the, have you ever thought about this? We say that it's so good the sacrifices are done away with, and it is, that they had to keep offering those sacrifices over and over. But there's a thing that we do all the time, over and over and over, that keeps us in the covenant, and it's that thing right there. That's what keeps us in the covenant of Christ. It's our continual participation in it. 1 Corinthians 11:26 through 27. So we've seen mediation, we've seen blood, and finally death. "For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Whoever therefore eats or the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty concerning the body and blood of the Lord." The death occurred once for all, but we are reminded of it and we proclaim it every week. Why it's so important that we do this every week and not once a month or twice a year or once a quarter is that our participation in the Lord's Supper, the communion, is the equivalent, the heavenly thing, right? Because he's talked a lot about the shadows and the copies, that the Old Testament stuff was the shadow and the copy. Might I suggest that their continually offered blood sacrifices was a shadow of this thing? That Jesus died, he sacrificed, he's done, then that's over and done with, but we still need to participate in the covenant. We still need to be involved in the agreement that we have with Christ, with God. And it is through this thing, the participation in the bread and the cup, that's how we do that weekly. Every time we do that, we continually proclaim his death and have access to the blood of the covenant and participate in the mediation that he offers. For the Christian, participation in the Lord's Supper ensures and reinforces continual involvement in the covenant of Christ. That's why this matters so much, why it's so important that we do this. And this should have, for what it's worth, a tangible effect on our lives. The verse we've already read, but the verse we're going to conclude with, Hebrews 9, 27 and 28, "Just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin," as I've said, he's already done that, "but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him." How do you demonstrate that you're eagerly waiting for Jesus? As opposed to waiting what? Oh, is he here yet? No. When's he going to get here? I'm bored. Right? Don't we have that attitude sometimes as Christians? We're not eagerly anticipating Jesus' return. We're not excited about the thing that we get to be involved in. We're not glad and we're not rejoicing. We're just sort of bleh. Part of it's, of course, the weekly involvement in the Lord's Supper. Part of it's the transformed life of the new creation, right? That I know he's going to come back eventually, and part of my eagerly waiting for him is that as the time I have left, I'm going to live that transformed life. And Paul says something very similar, right? whether to go or to stay, whether to die and be the Lord or stay and be with you, I don't know what I should choose. Because as long as I'm here, I can still serve. I can still serve Christ and benefit you. That's a demonstration of the eagerness. That, yeah, of course he wanted to be with God, but there were things he could still do for God. And he was excited to be a part of that process. Part of it, of course, is the excitement to share with others. And the question that I want to conclude with is, do you eagerly wait? Excitedly wait for him? When we view our relationship with God as a burden, are we eagerly waiting for him? When we refuse to change the way we live, are we eagerly waiting for him? When we hoard our knowledge for ourselves, our knowledge of salvation, are we eagerly waiting for him? Or are we just sort of going through the motions? It is impossible to overstate the awesomeness of our Savior. Use whatever superlative you want. You can't overstate it, right? The things that he's quoted, the things that he said just in Hebrews 9, he has secured an eternal redemption. He said that in Hebrews 9. Who provides the promised eternal inheritance. He said that in Hebrews chapter 9. Who has put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. He said that in chapter 9. You can't overstate how great that is. How amazing it is that he did that for us. And the question is, what will it take to convince us of the greatness of what we get to be a part of? As opposed to treating it like some boring obligation that I have to go through. Do you realize what you're doing when you do this every week? That you are interacting with the blood of the one who saved you, that you are professing and proclaiming his death, that you are getting to participate in the greatest thing that has ever befell humanity, the greatest thing that God has ever given to mankind, that's what you're doing when you do this thing? That it has eternal ramifications? I don't know. He invites you to sign on to the covenant, right? You could be, like we think about an agreement and the idea of contract language. You could sign on to that at any time. And he invites you to do that if you'll agree to his terms, right? Because it's not an unconditional covenant. There are some agreements on both sides. If you're willing to agree to his terms, man, you can be a part of the greatest thing that's ever given to humanity. If you're willing to submit to his will. And I pray that you are.